Hello. My first novel was rejected. I haven't actually counted the number of times. More than 30, I think. I used to distinguish between the rejections that began Dear Benjamin and the rejections that began Dear Benjamin, but the Benjamin was lifted slightly off the line of the page. It took me 10 years to write. And if it had been accepted the first time around, it would have taken me 5 years to write. It took 5 years being rejected and being rewritten. The good thing about being rejected is that I didn't know the people who were rejecting me. And once you get published and little ways you continue to be rejected, you do know them. So in some ways it's worse. The other thing I used to console myself with was the reflection that the people who did reject me might have liked the movie Crouching Tiger and Hidden Dragon. The truth was that it is their job to reject people, which I also learned when I got published. It seemed to me the best thing about being a writer, both before I was published and after, is that you get to do what you do regardless whether or not anyone says yes to you. Unlike actors. And in fact, if you do get published, you will continue to have to write. So that being published makes very little difference to your working life, except that you might get a small amount of money or a slightly larger amount of money. There's a line I thought of before my first novel came out. I reviewed a book by Dawn Powell, who described the period before publication as the calm before the calm. The novel I'm going to read from is published this week. I think the launch is in 2 days' time. It's the second novel in a trilogy I'm working on about Lord Byron. First was published last year, and it was about Byron's doctor, Polidori, who wanted to be a writer and succumbed to his sense of the fact that he couldn't do it as well as Byron. Maybe it's time for a gloomy note that one of my formative experiences was playing professional basketball after college, in which I realized very painfully that I wasn't as good as the other people. I could console myself with the thought that I had other virtues and talents. The terrible thing about writing is that I'm not sure, if you're not as good a writer as other people, what those other virtues and talents are in some ways, because writing is supposed to encompass or can encompass the whole of a personality. That's my very gloomy note. The second novel is in part a response to the gloominess of the first, in which Polidori recognizes his inferiority to Byron. This is also the novel of a woman who recognizes the charms and the graces that she lacks in comparison with Byron. But in her case, she triumphs over him. I'm going to be reading a scene set shortly after their marriage. After they've been married, they don't know each other very well. They were alone together, almost for the first time. But until they passed the gates, Lord Byron continued, from a sense perhaps of being still in eyeshot, to stare straight ahead of him at the underside of the carriage roof. The line of his profile was vividly distinct against the white background. "How well I know it," she reflected lovingly, then remembered having seen it for years on his frontispiece. The thought struck her, "I have married a famous man." As they were turning into the road, a violent crack of sound erupted behind them. It startled Annabella into breathing. She had half been holding her breath and now leaned her head out the window to look back. The servants in a ragged line at the front of the house stood darkly holding muskets to their shoulders. They had just fired off a volley. Annabella, in a surge of high spirits, laughed at that she could hardly have put it into words herself, at the show of it for such a quiet, virtuous, studious country girl. Lord Byron, determining to break their silence, found only something to recite. "Such a sight as this," he said, becomes the field, but here shows much amiss. I'm sure my father, she began to say, very eager, if nothing else, to placate him, until she noticed he was smiling faintly. She smiled more broadly at him, indifferent for once to the fact that smiles only made her round face rounder. Then he took her hands in his. You should have married me 2 years ago, he said. For a moment she thought he meant only a kind of whimsy, a regret that the happiness they now shared had been put off needlessly for so long, and she wanted an endearment to respond in kind. What shall I call you, sir? She said. I can scarcely call you, however much I might think of you, as my lord. I suppose we'll find names for each other in time. Again his manner puzzled her, but she took his remark as a corrective, the first of their marriage, from his larger store of experience in such matters. My love, my sweet, she had wanted to say. And Annabella found that she was willing to an extent that surprised her to be guided by him. She felt herself pushing a little impatiently at Lord Byron, a fact gently brought home to her by a certain pressure on her own affections. It could only be caused, however innocently, by his rebuff. They had time, he seemed to be saying, as much as they could want. She was hurrying him. The coachman, she noted in passing, had ignored her father's advice and taken the road to Durham after all, a disobedience which, in its way, duly comforted her. She was traveling outside a sphere of influence that she had been accustomed to thinking of as the world itself. To escape it had been, in many ways, the object of her marriage. She had escaped. The snow, which had held off in the morning, now began lightly as spiders to descend. On landing, the new flakes, many-footed, stood resting on the old. The road was still passable, though they encountered little traffic in the course of the day. Everyone, it seemed, had decided to stop at home. And this only contributed to Annabella's sense of venturing forth, of embarking. Trees to either side of them broke darkly against the muffled sunshine, which was of that charged, oppressive whiteness that suggests the imminence of a thunderclap. It seemed to Annabella not the least of her anxieties, drawn out over the length of that endless journey, that no thunder came, that the heavens continued to thicken silently while the snow softened underfoot. That cushioning, above and below, rendered their voices on those rare occasions when they spoke, and the knock of the horses' hooves and the cries of their driver, both quiet and curiously distinct. Only the light changed as the day wore on, and the pallor of the horizon took on a deepening yellow stain. At Durham, as they trotted through it, the bells rang out. Lord Byron at last broke his silence. Ringing for our happiness, I presume. She could not read his tone. Was he asking for corroboration? Of what? The fact of the intention to honor their wedding day, or the fact of their happiness? She decided to understand him simply. I expect we have been looked out for, he smiled at that. I expect we have. She was beginning to tire from the strain of his presence. There was a moment as the shuttered shops sped by when she thought of stopping the carriage and getting out. They were running along the high street and past the millinery store above whose bright red shop front Mrs. Claremont lived. She was an old friend of the Milbanks and had been Annabella's governess for many years. Annabella considered it a kindness to visit. She sometimes journeyed to Durham only to take her a cake and a bag of tea and sit for an hour with her. It seemed to her the most natural thing in the world to knock against the roof of the coach and descend, leaving Lord Byron to proceed to Hannaby alone, to talk with Mrs. Claremont in her little room overlooking the street. Annabella had, after all, a great deal to gossip about, the most natural thing, not nearly so strange as the other. But she did not knock, and the carriage continued regardless, and the houses of Durham grew scarcer on either side of the road, then disappeared altogether on the ascent towards Crook. They drove for a space along the river. It somewhat consoled her to see its current flowing thickly the other way, back to Siam and the sea. Once, to relieve the silence, perhaps, Lord Byron broke into a kind of song. Annabella could not make out the words. It had an Eastern ring and reminded her of just those poems through which she had first come to know him. "Will you teach it me?" she interrupted at last. He started as if he had forgotten her and said roughly, "You wouldn't much like to know what you were singing." She bowed her head at this, humbly and hurt, and he, seeming to repent, took her hand in his and kissed it. He left his lips on her skin, looking up at her, and then, with growing fervor, began to kiss her palm, dropping it as suddenly again. "You might have saved me once," he said. "Now it is too late. I fear very much you will find you have married a devil." Annabella endured all this silently, but no explanation followed, and she hadn't the heart to require one. She had the sense of waiting him out. What she was waiting for, not just in name, but in shape and force, oppressed her thoughts, his too, perhaps. And she hopefully supposed that the source of the awkwardness between them, just as it might prove the solution to it. Her first tastes of passion, such as they were, had surprised an appetite she little suspected herself of possessing. She had proved, as Lord Byron said to her, quite caressible into good humor. Just what else she might be caressible into began to occupy her more and more as they left Durham behind. There was nothing he couldn't do to her. There was nothing, she guessed, she would not let him do. She was conscious even then of reserving for herself a passive part, the burden of anticipation, the task of supporting it, seemed to her active enough. There were in the course of a long journey several mute exchanges that seemed, as Annabella put it to herself, to bear upon the question. Lord Byron had kissed her hand. She had observed him feeling heat rise to her face. Once, the coachman taking too quickly a bend in the road, she had found herself resting her head against him while he kept quiet and still. In the act of righting herself, Annabella put her hand against his thigh. As she gathered her weight, the carriage lurched again. Lord Byron, curiously inert, supported her shoulder and head upon his breast, and closing her eyes, she for a moment remained recumbent upon him by a forced inaction. The seconds passed, neither stirred, until the carriage, turning the opposite way, by its own speed, released her from its involuntary embrace. Nothing was said, but the silence itself persuaded her that whatever she felt of uneasiness, of attraction, was shared by him. At the inn in Rushyford, they changed horses. Stepping out briefly into the snowy air, she observed him wince. "I hate the cold," he said. And she, rising at once to meet him in sympathy, replied, "It must be painful for your..." until he stared her out of the end of her sentence. She didn't yet dare. They spent a few minutes inside, warming their hands together at the fire with their backs to the room. She wanted at least to make a show of conversation. It was their wedding day, after all. There were people about. "How much longer to Hanaby is it, do you suppose?" To which he repeated, "You should have married me when I first proposed." She, at a push, found something to smile at this time. "I think you mean that it can't be as long as 2 years." And then, when he did not look up, she added, "Surely, now, there's no need to regret the past. We have time enough." But the coachman then returning, Lord Byron was spared an answer and preceded his bride briskly into the carriage. The sun set before them in a muffle of cloud, though for a bright half hour they squinted against the pervading whiteness. It was an 8-hour journey to Hanaby from Siam, but through the long day she looked at him perhaps a dozen times. He so insistently stared in front. Annabella had not known what to expect of their enforced solitude. it had not been this electric silence. She had supposed herself rather in danger of too readily complying to his greed for her, that was her phrase for it, and had wasted her anxieties in composing ahead of time a number of subjects on which they might calmly discourse. None of them now, as she counted them over in her head, seemed appropriate. She could almost smile with the wisdom of a wife at the girl she had been. Of course, Lord Byron was right. Such silence was just what would suit them. It had the tendency in her, at least, to arouse her own greed for him, though as the dark set around them, that greed appeared to her in its plainest form. She was terribly lonely and cold. She wanted, more than anything, a word of comfort from him, a little warmth. Nightfall, it seemed, had its own effect upon him. In the darkness, she ventured to examine her husband more closely. Curly hair partly obscured his high forehead and the peculiar fineness of his ears, which were harp-like, distinctly shaped. His blunt, masculine nose and square, cleft chin suggested the soldier or the statesman more than the poet. But his lips and large eyes were almost indecently soft and boyish, eloquent of vanities and sympathies and enthusiasms, to say nothing of a painful susceptibility to his own changing temper. There was bitterness, too, written in the lines between his brows and around his mouth. Feeling her gaze upon him, he burst out, "This is intolerable," and when she shrank at the edge of tears into her corner of the carriage, he turned towards her for the first time in an hour with an urgency of manner that was not ungentle. "I wonder how much longer I shall be able to keep up the part I have been playing." It was all she could do to summon a little voice. "Have you been playing a part, my lord? I wish you would not. I should not have thought we needed parts to play." "Come now," he said. "You have only been pretending to love me. You cannot love me as I am." And then, in her highest tone, which she for the first time suspected of priggishness, Annabella replied, "That is what I have vowed to do, brave girl." His face in deep shadow was almost unreadable. Was he mocking her? She finally took her courage in both hands. "Have you been only pretending to love me?" Her voice, as she asked it, was perfectly steady and clear. There was not the tremor of an appeal. They had come to the point. But only then did Annabella guess how awkwardly she had felt it intruding, regardless of the way she wriggled. Ever since his first proposal, throughout their protracted engagement and that long day's silent journey. Afterwards, she remembered the question and marveled at how simply she had faced it. "How can you ask me that?" he said, at his wit's end. Her nerve failed her then. Annabella decided to take this as reassurance enough. There were tears on both sides, which he caressed them out of, kissing them off her chin, her cheeks, the line above her lip. She put her palms to his face and with her fingers rubbed the wet out of his eyes. She had never touched his face. His hand, with the force almost of anger, ran down her neck and the length of her spine. He began to grip her thigh from behind her, and she felt for the first time the indifference to everything else of the appetite he had awakened. There was nothing like sentiment in it, very little like love, and she waited with shut eyes to feel what else he might do to her when the coach slowed to a halt and the coachman knocked his fist against the roof. Hanaby Hall had appeared in its own light, 8 splendid windows in 2 rows casting a mullioned glitter. The servants, a half dozen of them, stood on the balcony above the drive to greet the happy couple. Thank you.